You Dig It with Dr. Craig Barker.
We're going to check in with Dr. Craig Barker from the University of Sydney to find out what's been making news in archaeology. Good evening, Craig.
Hello, Rihanna. How are you?
I am well. Now, this first story, it's not often that you get medieval porpoise grave in the same headline, but I felt like we needed to go here because it has archaeologists puzzled.
You've been Google searching again, haven't you?
Yeah, I just put in porpoise grave and see what comes up.
Yeah. Well, a fantastic story which has picked up in a few of the media networks, including The Guardian, about excavations on the island of Chapelle Dom Hugh off the west coast of Guernsey, so in the channel, in the English Channel. As they were clearing the site, spotted a couple of very well-cut bedrock rectangular cut holes into the bedrock, and assuming it would be a human burial. But as they dig further, they've unearthed a buried skull and indeed the entire body of a porpoise. So raising really interesting questions. It's a 14th century AD, so it's medieval period. Why the porpoise was actually buried so carefully on the island. At the time, too, when the island was actually primarily being used as a place for solitude for monks, is something of a mystery. There's a couple of options. One is that it might have just been something that they've washed ashore and they've eaten, but in which case, why not rebury it at sea or just dump it somewhere? A couple of theories have been put forward. One that it may have actually been placed in the hole with salt to actually preserve it. Another intriguing theory that's been put forward is that perhaps it actually had some degree of religious significance. The dolphin did actually have quite strong significance in Christianity, but that's probably quite a long bow to stretch as well. So really, really interesting a bit of a mystery.
And Craig, is it often that we see a porpoise grave?
Well, I can't say I've ever come across one in my career, but that doesn't necessarily mean much. But, I mean, normally any type of animal which is either, hunted for food purposes or has, been washed ashore, accidentally or something like that, if they turn up in archaeological context, it's often sort of an isolated bone or something like that. But to actually go to some degree of deliberate care in burying it, it's rather unusual.
Now, Craig, there's also been a little bit discovered about Bronze Age women and how far they travelled.
Yeah, really, really interesting research published earlier this month. It's a project largely conducted by the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich and the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History. And it's based on the investigation of a series of early Bronze Age, late Neolithic Copper Age and early Bronze Age tombs in the Lech Valley in Germany, very, very close to Augsburg. And the study of something, I believe it's 84 individuals using both genetic and isotopic analysis. And I think we talked about isotope analysis a couple of months ago, but in conjunction with archaeological evaluation of the types of tombs and the types of burials, we've discovered rather interestingly, and these bodies were all buried somewhere between around about 2500 and 1650 BC, so sort of over a period of a millennia. What's really interesting is that over these many, many generations, it's almost universal that the majority of the women are coming from outside of the local area, most likely probably from central Germany or from Bohemia in the modern Czech Republic, while the men, the male graves that were studied, seem to be people that are local from the region of their birth. There's a big theory behind this. It's the so-called patrilocal pattern, basically suggests that for a period of around about 800 to 1,000 years, during that transition from the Neolithic into the early Bronze Age, what you've got is that the local men are marrying women from nearby regions, and these women are actually transporting or moving over large areas. And that the women, seemingly, as a result, the women being born in the local region are marrying back where the other women are coming from as well. So it's a really, really interesting analysis and really, really interesting just insight into that sort of early Bronze Age societal relationships over long distances in this part of Germany at this point in time. Really interesting, the analysis of the strontium isotope ratios and the molars and the teeth of the women, the best evidence in terms of drawing conclusions about the origin of where these women are coming from. But it's interesting that, you know, the style of burials, the types of grave goods that they're being buried with are not differing at all from those of the native population, which indicates that the formerly foreign women, as they're marrying, are being fully integrated into this local community. And from an archaeological perspective, this really gives an insight into not just female mobility over this point in time, but also cultural exchange. The Philip Stockhammer, who's the researcher who's led the project, actually writes that it appears that at least part of what was previously believed to be migration by groups is actually based upon an institutionalized form of individual mobility. So really amazing insight into the way people communicated with one another and linked with one another such a long time ago.
So essentially, Craig, Bronze Age man needs a wife.
Yes.
That would be the reality spin-off but show.
Not going to marry the girl from the nearby village. We're going to marry the girl from far, far away. So there you go. Lots of roses exchanged, I suspect.
And if we sort of shift it back a little bit to Italy, the earliest Italian wine. Now, yes. This is an area that you... This is your jam, isn't it, Craig?
It is, yes. As you well know, ancient wine research is my bread and butter as an archaeologist. And so I'm always always excited about any new research. As with most archaeological areas of investigation, the earliest is one of the key questions and one of the interesting areas. So in terms of Italy, it's always been assumed that wine production began in the Middle Bronze Age, around about 1300 to around about 1100 BC in central and southern Italy. A new project based out of the University of South Florida, but it's been investigating unglazed pottery found in the Chalcolithic period, or the Copper Age, the early 4th millennium BC, around about 3000 BC, so much, much earlier. The chemical residue analysis done on a series of unglazed pottery found in a series of tombs very close to Agrigento, near Sicily. And the residue contents of these vessels contain acid and sodium salt, which naturally occurs in grapes and is released during the fermentation process or the winemaking process. So what it seems to suggest, and their article, which has been published this month in Microchemical Journal, which I must admit is not something I do normally read, but what it's actually suggesting is that it's the earliest wine residue discovered anywhere in the Italian peninsula, and it's pushing the date of wine production by humans in that part of the world back at least 1,000 years. So that's very, very exciting. But also, Again, really nice example, too, of just the role of chemical analysis and other types of scientific investigation. We'll talk a bit more about this when we're talking about the plaster cast from Pompeii later on as well, too. But how much our work as archaeologists is now dependent upon the work of the hard sciences, the chemists, the physicists, the medical researchers, and so on as well. And the equipment that they use is being modified and adapted for our own research. So that's also a really exciting insight into sort of where archaeology is heading in the 21st century.
Well, how do archaeologists date wine, Craig?
Well, I mean, the most common way is either upon the discovery of seeds of wines or grape seeds, and so they can be carbon dated or dated using other scientific methods. The other thing, of course, is the production of vessels for the storage, for the manufacture, and of course for the consumption of the wine. And they most often are dated based upon, you know, normal analysis of ceramics and, you know, different typologies and the changes to those shapes over time as well. But it's really interesting because, I mean, it's one of those things that the date of wine production, the date of beer production for that matter too, in various parts of the world, this keeps on being pushed back and back and back and further and further and further. So this is kind of interesting. There's a whole series of experimental projects as well that are, you know, trying to actually remake ancient alcohols and remake ancient wines. And, you know, Pompeii, as we talk about later on, is actually, there's a number of experimental wineries within the archaeological site where they're actually, you know, using the same types of, same varieties of grapes that that we're pretty certain were growing in the Campania region at the time of the eruption. So all sorts of really interesting projects. A guy called Patrick McGovern out of the University of Pennsylvania has been, you know, at the forefront of a lot of this research over the past sort of three, 4 decades. And he's worked with a couple of local breweries in America to actually produce ancient Egyptian beer and things like that as well.
I'm Rhianna Patrick. This is ABC Radio, and Can You Dig It with Dr. Craig Barker is about to take a look at some of the exhibitions and events that have caught his eye. Craig, I got excited when I saw the two words animal mummies.
Yes, it's an exhibition that opens on Friday at the Brooklyn Museum in New York City. It's running through until January, so if any of our listeners are passing through NYC for Christmas or New Year's, it's a chance to go and see. The exhibition's called Soulful Creatures, Animal Mummies in Ancient Egypt. We spoke a little bit about animal mummies when we talked about mummies a couple of months ago, but really, really remarkable tradition in ancient Egypt for thousands of years, not just mummifying humans, but also animals, particularly cats and the ibis. But there's a whole range. The Nicholson Museum, where I work at Sydney Uni, actually has some baby crocodile mummies, believe it or not.
Fantastic.
And if you go to the Cairo Museum, of course, there's the famous mummified hippopotamus. So there's a whole range of animals. Why the Egyptians actually mummify these animals, we don't know, to be honest. But the assumption is that it's, you know, most closely related to the whole process of the Egyptian gods and goddesses actually being, you know, associated with animals, and that you have that link between the temple estate with, you know, particular animals. So the scribe god Thoth, for example, associated with the ibis and so on. So this is an exhibition which is going to actually use over 30 mummies from the Brooklyn Museum's collection. It's an incredible collection they have from ancient Egypt. But to explore the whole process. So it sounds a really, really interesting exhibition.
Well, if we stay with the thought of Egypt, Craig, there's a new online archive of World War One era images of Egypt.
That's right. It's a project run out of Cardiff University, and it's only just gone live in the last few weeks, but it's called the Views of Antique Land Projects. What it's done is to actually collect thousands of images from Egypt and Palestine taken during the First World War. And again, from an Australian perspective, of course, there are so many images in Australian archives, and particularly the War Memorial, but of Anzacs who have been in Cairo and, you know, at the pyramids prior to the Gallipoli campaign, or, of course, the Australian Light Horse in the Middle East as well. So there's a very strong Australian connection. I'm sure that many of our listeners probably actually have photos themselves of ancestors who were in either Egypt or in the Middle East during the war, or part of the training process before going off to campaign. So what's remarkable about this project is that it's a great memorial and a great visual archive, which is now online and available for all of us to actually explore of the First World War, but from an archaeological perspective, some remarkable images of towns, cities, and archaeological sites as they looked in 1914 to 1918, and of course a great chance for us to actually appreciate just how much they've changed in the intervening century as well too. So really, really interesting site, the Views of Antique Land Project.
And there's also, I mean, what are this online archive of Roman images that we can find now as well?
Yeah. And I mean, it's a very exciting time in many ways, because with digitization projects that are taking place all over the world, focusing and investigating on particular aspects of collections and collectors from the past. But this is a really interesting one. Again, it's only gone live in the last couple of weeks as well. But it's over 4,000 records scanned from the collection of Rodolfo Lancini. From his archives. Lancini was an archaeologist working in Rome from the 1870s until he passed away in 1929. And his archives that have ended up in the National Institute of Archaeology and Art History in Rome are technically publicly accessible, but, you know, it was only open on, you know, every second Tuesday in the third month of the year and that type of thing. So by going through and scanning them and digitizing them and now putting them onto this great online resource, it means that scholars from around the world can actually access them. To date, over 4,000 records, as I said before, estimated to be only a quarter of the entire collection. So there's still a lot of work to go. What he was doing was trying to document the entire Roman or the entire archaeological legacy of the city of Rome. So he's not only going out to excavations as they're taking place in the late 19th century and photographing them, but also taking on board all sorts of images. There's a series of great photographs of the excavation of the bronze statue, the boxer at rest, which was found in 1885 at the Quirinal Hill in Rome. And, here's some rare opportunity to actually see it coming out of the ground, for example. But on top of that, he also had a massive library of books. And he did what... we're all told not to do, which is he actually tore the books apart and ripped out the images and would recategorize them according to site-specific research from different parts of Rome. So what's great about the website is it's actually presenting it as he was collecting them back in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s as well. So really, really interesting archive and just a great, for lovers of Rome and lovers of the city, a great chance to just to get an idea of what it looked like 120 years ago, 100 years ago.
And Craig, what's happening with Trotsky's ice pick?
Well, I threw this one into the mix because, I mean, we've talked about this in the past as well too, but I mean, this concept of archaeology that people tend to think that we're only dealing with thousands of years ago and we're only dealing with pharaoh's tombs and all of these types of things. But one of the things I hope this segment on your show does is to actually get people to appreciate that, archaeology is an investigation of all aspects of human endeavour and all aspects of human history, both really ancient and also quite new. And that archaeology is really the study of anything, be that gold death mask, be those bodies from Pompeii, or be that rubbish that was thrown out a few weeks ago. So what's interesting, of course, is the famous ice pick that killed Leon Trotsky in 1940 in Mexico City, that actually disappeared for decades and decades and decades.
Really?
But yeah. No one actually knew where it was, because what had happened was, of course, he was assassinated. The ice pick was then, collected by the Mexican police. It was actually unveiled in a press conference in the 1940s, then stored in a new Mexico City evidence room for a number of years, checked out by a secret police officer at one stage because he argued he wanted to actually preserve it, and it then vanished. And turned out he did actually preserve it. So his daughter or granddaughter, I can't remember, I think it was his granddaughter, actually kept it underneath her bed for over 40 years, popped up, tried to actually give it to some of Trotsky's descendants, but in the end sold it to a private American collector. And that private collector is now donating it to the International Spy Museum in Washington.
Oh, cool.
Now, I must admit, I've never been to the International Spy Museum, but a number of friends and colleagues who actually have say it is remarkable. It sounds like the place that you would love too, Ree. So I'm not
it's
sure
on if my some, list.
Of, some of our listeners might have been there as well, but I'm told it's an extraordinary place. So anyway, as of early next year, the ice peak, complete with bloodstains that killed Leon Trotsky in 1940, will be displayed for the public for the first time ever. Slightly gruesome, but a remarkable archaeological artifact in the true sense of the word.